segues into my next guest a little bit with Bill Wirtz is joining us. He's a senior policy analyst at the Consumer Choice Center. Want to welcome you to the show, Bill.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Yeah, I think we talked in March. H706 was a Vermont bill that bans pesticides in sort of the planting world. Can you just tell us a little bit, give us some background on the bill, remind our viewers what we're talking about?
Yeah, sure. So Bill H706 would ban the use of neonicotinoid-treated seeds in Vermont agriculture. So neonicotinoids are a group of insecticides that farmers use in order to protect their crops from insects eating away at their crops. And it's a pretty common group of insecticides, and it's an EPA-approved insecticide. But it's also criticized by some people because they believe that it harms pollinators, specifically bees. And this has actually led New York to impose a ban that will begin in 2029. And with this bill, Vermont would essentially do the same thing with maybe a year or two difference in schedule. And essentially what I've been communicating in different venues is that there's not enough scientific proof for that being the case, and that therefore, given the risk to farmers in terms of their crop yields, but also to consumers with higher prices for their food, which is already a problem, that the bill should be rejected. And so that was essentially the back and forth argument that happened on this. The bill was approved by both houses, unfortunately, but it was vetoed on May 20th by Governor Scott.
And my recollection is that this is a insecticide that goes into the seed of the plant. Is that correct? And goes underground, and then the corn or whatever will grow from there?
Yes, it's a seed coating. So essentially, you buy the seeds, and they're already ready to be used. And so that creates another problem, because very often this is not something that is done in Vermont. So if you want to get seeds that don't have neonic coating, if Vermont were to implement a ban, it would have to compete with the only other jurisdiction in the United States where that is. What that ban would be implemented, which is New York, and New York having, also a certain size of agricultural landscape, that would mean that essentially Vermont and New York would rival each other on trying to get seeds that nobody else in the United States and in the farming world wants to buy. And I think that was probably, I can't read Governor Scott's mind, and he didn't argue it like that in his veto letter, but I think that was also one of the big concerns, is that it would be very difficult for farmers to get their hands on those seeds, those seed alternatives.
So what is the genesis of a ban? I know, obviously, we all want environmental stewardship, but if the science wasn't there, did it become an emotional issue, or how do you depict it?
It is, I think, agriculture has increasingly become an emotional issue. People have, you don't really have this with any other consumer good. I mean, we all walk around with a smartphone, but if you asked your average consumer what's actually inside a smartphone, I think most of us wouldn't know. If it breaks, we bring it to the magic phone guy and he or she will fix it for us. But with food, consumers have justifiably strong views on how it is produced. But when it comes to synthetic crop protection, you need to have a certain notion of chemistry, or at least a strong interest in it, in order to understand what it means that there's a difference between hazard and risk, that it depends on dosage, that not everything that has chemical written on it would necessarily kill you. I mean, everything is essentially chemical. Just by drinking water, you're drinking chemicals. But So what I see is that there is a certain group of people that feels very strongly that all agriculture should be organic and it should be produced without any chemical inputs, and thus will have a tendency, let's say, to exaggerate potential risks. And it is, to me, perfectly acceptable that people want to buy a certain set of products, and that's why those should be available, whether you're buying locally from the farm that you trust or whether you buy at a certain retail store that sells only organic. That's a choice. But the fact is also that most consumers make different choices, sometimes for financial reasons, sometimes because they see the world differently. And banning certain products and making farmers, essentially making those choices for the farmer, I don't think that's the right way to go about it. If there is a best practice, let's do it this way. This is how it works better. Farmers will pick those ways to grow their crops. I mean, farmers are not in the business of trying to enrich a chemicals manufacturer. They use those products to the degree that they need it in order to protect that they have a yield that they can rely on for the season. So I think that as farming has become politicized, I think there is a real scenario in which farmers become more political. And I think the European example with farmer protests en masse is a good depiction of how that has sort of been unfolding over the last, let's say, 10, 20 years.
So we have a seed that is coated with a insecticide. Is the predator to the seed under the ground, or is it when it emerges from the ground and it protects it at that point, or both?
It protects it at the outside. So you have everything from seed corn maggots, for instance. They will eat away at crops, including silage or corn. So depending on how you, there's really no way you can organize your storage for livestock farming for silage corn that will protect you from seed corn maggots. So you couldn't insulate it well enough to protect those maggots from getting in. So the neonic coating essentially makes those insects reject trying to touch those crops. And at the same time, many of the crops that neonic-treated seeds are used for are actually also not pollinated by bees. A good example was that in France, where because of EU regulation, neonicotinoids are currently not allowed, sugar beet farmers were on the verge of collapse in 2020, and they said, we would like to have an exemption. And the justification also for why the exemption was granted is that sugar beet crops are actually not pollinated by bees. So even in the scenario in which neonicotinoids were bee killers, which I don't think the science bears that out, it still wouldn't be a risk because bees are not interested in pollinating those crops. So that's why this debate is so nuanced. And, we can have a whole conversation on the bee numbers and how to count them and whether an increase in bee population that we're currently seeing disproves that neonics are to blame. I think it does, but I think it helps for people to also talk to farmers about this, because in the process of the testimonies that I saw in the House and Senate, the farmers that were testifying seemed to also have told the lawmakers a lot of things that they previously didn't know. And I think in a stage where you already drafted a bill and then only then you talk to the farmers about how they actually use those products, I think that's often a bit too late. I think you need to get interested a bit earlier in the legislative process about how does this actually work on the ground? What are farmers using this for?
We are talking with Bill Wirtz. He's a senior policy analyst at the Consumer Choice Center about House Bill 706, which passed in the Senate and in the House. Governor Phil Scott has vetoed it. It will be headed to a veto override session June 17th and 18th. We'll get back to that in a minute, Bill, but I'm going to go to the phone lines. Norm is calling in. Welcome, Norm.
Thank you very much. I listen to you all the time. This program that you have today with the nicotinoids, I've been involved with that since I am a fruit producer, mostly for myself, but I did sell it for a while. I still have all the plants in there. A lot of them are in blossom right now or have just passed. But I have noticed no honeybees at all. And I used to have honeybees all over those blossoms every year for probably the last 20 years or more. And I went to a movie quite a while ago where they discussed this problem. And they were saying that all the agricultural corn was going to one place in the world, and it was someplace in South America. Can't remember which country it was, but they were being sprayed with this nicotinoid spray. And then it was shipped all over the world. Now, we have a person here in the Middlebury area who has been raising bees. His family has been raising them, I think, for five generations. And his name is Charlie Mraz. Now, he would be somebody very interesting to have on your show at some point and discussing this issue. So I was wondering if maybe that's a possibility.
Yeah, of course. And I thank you for the call and the comments, Norm. And if you want to listen in, maybe Bill can answer that.
All right, that would be great.
Thank you, Norm.
Gladly. You can have specific regional and local disappearances of bee populations. That is is commonplace. That is multifactorial. It can be because of urbanization. It can be because of a virus that spreads within those bee colonies. That is something that beekeepers also know that they have to deal with. On the macro level, so if you look at the USDA census, between 2017 and 2022, the Vermont honeybee population has grown by about 30%. Overall in the United States, also an additional 1 million honeybees in that same time period. So overall, those bee populations are going up. The issue is also when you distinguish between managed bees and wild bees. So if you notice a lot of wild bees around your farm, that can change seasonally, and it can change because of wind and climate. And the issue is when we try to gather data on this, it's very difficult to count wild bees. It's noticeably because they are wild. It's not something where you can just, you know, count them one by one. So we have to make estimates, and it's really, really difficult. There's certain ways of trying to count bees, and most of them are very scientifically disputed and discussed on whether it's an accurate way of going about it. So there can be several reasons for why you wouldn't notice it when in the previous years you have. But I think it's also important to note that if this was a direct consequence of neonicotinoids, it would have been something that we would have noticed since the 1990s when neonicotinoids became commercially available. So for something that would have happened would have started only a few years ago, that would be odd, especially also because we use neonicotinoids less than we did in the 90s, because we've gotten better at understanding which concentration levels are actually necessary. So farmers end up using less in order to spend less money, but also to become more efficient at the use of those chemicals. So, yeah, sometimes you can have a specific local issues that can be analyzed, but on a macro level, there's no evidence for large-scale bee apocalypse or whatever people want to call it.
And so let's return to the farmer, Vermont farmers. There was this, obviously, legislative bill, H-706, farmers I'm gathering, were coming into the State House to testify before committees. What were they saying?
Yeah, so I witnessed this firsthand because I also testified to the Senate Committee on Agriculture, and there were a few farmers also from families of farmers that testified in the committee, and what they said is why they use neonics, but also I think the most common question was, essentially, what would you have us do? Because what is supposed to be the alternative that we ought to use here? Because you can, I mean, it's also in organic farming. It's not like organic agriculture uses magic fairy dust. I mean, organic agriculture also uses chemicals. Copper sulfate, for instance, is one of them, which is essentially liquid copper. But that's an organic, considered organic, a pesticide. So what is the alternative that we're supposed to use? How are we supposed to ensure that we get the same yield without going back to the old chemicals that were a lot worse? And actually, there's a working paper by the Center for Agricultural and Rural Development at the Iowa State University. And when they looked at the bans on neonics in Europe, and I think they also used England specifically as an example, they look at oilseed rape production in England. Insect damage increased, insecticide resistance increased, yields decreased, and less oilseed rape was grown, was their conclusion. But also, they said that a lot of farmers moved back to older, still approved chemicals and end up using more of it, sometimes lacking the experience of the concentration needed on chemicals that are predate the 1990s. So I think what was lacking for the farmers was essentially give us the alternative. At least in the European Union, when neonics were banned, the political bodies were pitching individual alternative chemical and saying, well, we believe that this specific chemical would be better, so we will help you understand it better. In this case in Vermont, it felt like it was just trying to echo what was done in New York and say, well, we can do the same thing. And it happened, it was rushed, I feel. Mm-hmm. And it also relied on a Cornell University impact assessment that was drafted for New York and actually had no data or information about Vermont-specific inputs there. So I feel like it was, unfortunately, more of a political than a scientific move that was where for farmers was sufficiently consulted.
Well, I want to thank you. And also, Norm, I want to thank you for your call. And if you want to have Charlie give the station a call and some contact information, we are always welcome guests. And, Bill, thank you so much for the update. June 17th and 18th is the veto session override. We'll see what happens. But right now it stands that the governor vetoed the bill, and for now the treatment with insecticides is safe at the moment. But I appreciate you joining us.